Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, incomes, debts, all of that. I'm your weekly host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. Let me begin today's program with two announcements that I'm quite proud of. This last week, we relaunched our website, democracyatwork.info. That's democracy at work, all one word, .info. It is new, it is upgraded, it is expanded. We urge you to make use of the materials that are added to it every day. Lectures, documents, media interviews that I do, more writing by a whole host of people that's now going to be added in a regular way, and so on. democracyatwork.info. New, expanded, upgraded, but, as always, completely free of charge and available to you 24/7 at your convenience. My other announcement is a reminder. The second Wednesday of every month, in the evening at 7:30, I give a public lecture called the Monthly Economic Update, as I had the title, Global Capitalism. If you're in the Manhattan area, please come to beautiful Judson Memorial Church on historic Washington Square in Lower Manhattan and join us. It's an hour and a half, usually from 7:30 to around 9. I make a presentation with considerable analysis of what's going on, and there's sometimes a chance for back and forth questions. It's an opportunity for you to meet me and for me to meet you, as well as to continue the dialogue analyzing what's going on in the economy. Second Wednesday of every month, and therefore this coming Wednesday, August 12th at 7:30 p.m., Judson Memorial Church, Washington Square, New York City. I want to pick up on some stories we've covered in the past and cover them again because it's clear that interesting things have happened. The first concerns a socialist elected to the Seattle, Washington City Council. Her name is Kishama Sawant. She was elected. She has been performing very well. She is as much a socialist on the city council as she was a socialist running and winning that seat in a district with many tens of thousands of voters. Under the system that they have in Seattle, Washington, they have a primary. They held it this last week. The top two vote getters for every office then run against each other in the general election in November. So Kishama Sawant ran for re-election. She's famous for leading the fight for 15, getting a $15 minimum wage increase. She's fighting for a whole host of very classical socialist and progressive objectives. And it's interesting to note that in this re-election fight, the primary that was held last Tuesday, she came in first among a group of candidates. She got 50% of the vote. All the other candidates divided the rest. Coming in second was a gentleman named Banks. He got 35% of the vote, and the others got smaller amounts. I want to read from the Seattle Times, the major newspaper out there, the summary paragraph about Sawant's victory. This appeared in the Seattle Times, August 4th, a story by Daniel Beekman. Quote, Sawant battled several primary opponents, including Banks, whose candidacy has been largely bankrolled by business people fed up with the socialist council member. Clearly, Sawant commands a majority of the people. The only force arrayed against her that can get anywhere are the business people bankrolling one of the opponents she faces. It says reams without having to use many words to do it. Next story we're continuing. Last week I told you about a fine that was levied against the Chrysler Corporation, third largest automaker, basically, of the old Big Three of American automobiles, now owned by the Fiat Corporation of Italy. Fiat Chrysler was required to pay, depending on how you account for it, about $105 million. And I reported last week that that worked out to 0.1% of their annual revenue. And this is for crimes, basically, failing to recall vehicles that had serious problems, and therefore putting at risk 11 million vehicles over a 6 or 7 year period. This was profitable, apparently, for them to do, to avoid the recalls, to avoid the expense of recalls year in and year out, and so they were fined. But it only works out to 0.1% of their revenue, and this week Chrysler announced its profits, and guess what? Its profits in one quarter fell by only 3%, its profits. That was the cost to them of the billions in profits they raked in over the previous 6 or 7 years, in part by avoiding, evading recalls of cars whose damages killed a significant number of people. These are slaps on the wrist. They will not deter anybody from anything. And as if to underscore the story of Chrysler, here's another story from this last week. This one has to do with the UCLA Medical Center. It's called the Ronald Reagan Medical Center in Los Angeles. And they've gotten themselves into the news because there's a, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, duodenoscope that is used, a small camera that is put into your body to check against certain kinds of problems that you have, particularly in your intestines. And it turns out that this is a difficult piece of equipment to clean, and that therefore if you don't clean it properly and thoroughly, you can produce infections in people, even though what you're trying to do is to help them solve an intestinal problem. In 2013 and 14, the infections broke out in Europe, and they were traced to this machinery, which was made by something called the Olympus Corporation in Washington State. They did send out notices under pressure from this outbreak of infections, but they sent them only to European doctors and clinics. Wow, they didn't. They chose not to send those out to the United States doctors and clinics, which were using the same machine. Yup, you guessed it. In 2014 and 15, the same infectious problem broke out in the United States. And on May 15th, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, declared the scopes unsafe. There are suits against Olympus. People died. What's the story here? It's the same as with Chrysler. If you make the production of basic needs of a society subject to the profit-making calculations of corporations, they are going to over and over again do what the profits require, even if it means taking risks with the health and lives of the people, hypothetically, they're supposed to serve. The profit mechanism is an extremely dangerous way to organize any economy, and honest people have known that for a long time. Okay, updates this last week. Moving right along, U.S. wages and salaries rose over the last quarter, April, May, and June of this year, at the slowest rate since 1982. Let me make clear what that means. Wages and salaries rose 0.2% in this quarter. They've never risen that slowly since 1982. Wow. Even in 2008 and 9, when we were suffering from a major capitalist crash, wages and salaries in the quarters of that time rose faster than they are doing now. You get the idea that there's not much of a recovery going on? Good. But here's some additional things to think about. Over the same quarter in which wages and salaries rose 0.2%, the cost of living, the consumer price index, rose 4 times faster, 0.8%. You know what that means? That means the wages and salary increases, minimal as they were, weren't enough to cover the rising prices, so that working people, those who live off wages and salaries, actually could afford fewer items at the end of the last quarter than they could afford at the beginning. Last point. Our gross output, the total output of goods and services, and therefore the total income of the United States, rose much faster, 2.3%, instead of 0.2%. And what does that mean? Well, there are two ways to earn income in a capitalist society. One way is by working and being paid for your work. And the other way is by owning something and having other people produce more than they get in wages, so that that extra that they produce more than they get can be paid to people who aren't working for stuff that they own: land, money, machines, factories, the means of production. So you earn money either by working or by owning. If the total income goes up 2.3%, but what you get from working only goes up 0.2%, then all the rest is being earned by the people who own things. We call them the rich. This is an economic system rewarding them amply and rewarding labor not so much. Next item. The headlines, unbelievable. This week alone, 200 refugees from North and South Africa drown in a boat off the Libyan coast in the Mediterranean. There have been thousands that have died trying to get into Europe from the Middle East, from Africa, from Asia. They take enormous risks. They pay huge amount of money to criminals in many cases who offer them passage in rickety boats that sink, that capsize. The story is unspeakable. Men, women, children, old people dying in huge numbers. It's a scandal across Europe. It's front page news. The tragedy is unspeakable. Overwhelmingly, these people are trying to get economic advantages. They come from very poor countries. They sometimes suffer political or religious persecution. They ask only the chance in Europe to work, to get a job, yes, and also to take advantage of the social welfare provisions that the Europeans used to have. They often go to countries where they speak the language, and that means they come from what were former colonies. So they go to Britain if they were part of the British Empire in Africa and the Middle East, or they go to France if they were in a country that was part of the French Empire. Indeed, one of the reasons their economies are as poor and benighted as they are is because what they suffered through decades and in some cases centuries of colonialism. But here's the bottom line. It is a tragedy of spectacular proportions. What do I mean? In Europe, social welfare is being cut back. In Europe, wages are in trouble for workers. Unemployment is very high. If those refugees come in, these problems are going to get worse. Nationalistic sentiments in Europe turn against the refugees. They are seen and felt to be dangers for the local people. Race riots break out. Hostilities break out. Political support is given to movements who try to suggest to European people that the beginning and end of their economic woes have something to do with immigrants, which is not just an exaggeration, but simply a political falsehood. But it's an impossible position for all of these people to be in. And here's the point I want to make. This is a product of how this system works. Capitalism makes some parts of the world wildly better off than others. It has been doing that for 200 or 300 years. It would like us all to believe that some people don't work hard, but it has nothing to do that, as 10 minutes of investigation into these societies will show you. It's like the story between Greece and Germany. The Greeks work more hours than the Germans do. They work harder than the Germans do by all the measures we know. But there's the mythology that somehow Greek people don't work and the Germans are better off, not because capitalism has made them those with the jobs and so many others those without, but rather because of something having to do in the national character. Capitalism is irrational. It produces these problems. If you did more for the folks in those countries, they wouldn't be refugees. You wouldn't have the refugee problem. If capitalism developed the world in an even way, or at least less unevenly than it has, that would be a way to do this. And if there are too many people for jobs, then spread the jobs out. Make the workday shorter so that everybody can have a job, native and immigrant alike, and we can spread it out and therefore make for much better relationships amongst ourselves. These are the ways, dealing with the dysfunctional system that produces these conditions, so we don't see innocent people wanting a decent life dying in horrific way because of a system that can't function in an adequate human way. Next update. Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is for the United States what Greece is for Europe. It is a poor corner of the American economy. The incomes there, the standard of living, the access to social services, poorer than in most of the United States, the mainland. Yet, Puerto Rico is a colony. We took it from Spain in a war over 100 years ago, and we hold on to it as a nation. We just don't give it enough jobs. We just don't develop its economy. And we help to keep in charge politicians who solve the poverty problem in Puerto Rico in a way that politicians solve their problems everywhere. I'm going to come back later in the program with more of this, but let's quickly summarize. Politicians in Puerto Rico who were unable to develop an economic development plan, who were unwilling to provide the resources to really develop industry and agriculture in Puerto Rico, solved their political problem by borrowing. They entered into dangerous, ill-advised deals with banks, mostly in New York, who could make a lot of money by cutting a clever loan to these politicians. It made money for the banks in New York, and it made political careers for the politicians. They kept doing it because it kept them in office. They kept doing it because it generated profits. But eventually, as any idiot could have foretold them, you will borrow too much. Puerto Rico now owes $72 billion, the governor of Puerto Rico a few weeks ago announcing it can't be paid. And now the real ugliness starts. The banks and the creditors demand that Puerto Rico pay. What does that mean? That the mass of people pay. The politicians, they're not the ones. They've gone on to higher office, having borrowed their way into oblivion. So what's now going to happen? Well, the creditors have a clear idea. Close schools in Puerto Rico. Fire teachers. Cut the money to be given to the University of Puerto Rico and use the money instead to pay back the richest bankers in New York for the shady loans they concocted with unresponsive and ineffective political leaders. This makes people very angry. The injustice of it is grotesque. Final update for today that we'll have time for. This has to do with a young man named Tom Hayes. He's British. And this last week, he was sentenced to 14 years in jail in Great Britain. And this was because he manipulated interest rates as a highly paid employee of several major banks. I'm going to list some of those who hired him. Barclays, USB, Royal Bank of Scotland, Royal Bank of Canada, Deutsche Bank, and Citigroup. These were the same banks, I believe he worked for all of them, but certainly for most of them, who have also been paying huge fines since, of course, they all participated in manipulating interest rates because it made money for them. It's the profit motive in the banks that has made them do that. And now they're willing to pay the fines because, like Chrysler, these fines do not stack up as a serious problem from the profits they make by the unethical and illegal things they've done. Is the system, the profit-driven system of banking, being fundamentally altered to deal with this problem? No. Are state governments and federal governments taking over the banks so they become public utilities because you can't rely on a private bank seeing what they've all done over and over again? No. What we do instead is we find a fall guy. Tom Hayes is one, and he's going to go to jail for 14 years. At his trial, he said he never hid what he did because everybody does that in all the banks. He used words like widespread and blatant across the industry. Nobody wants to deal with the system and the structure. We prefer either to look the other way or to throw a few hapless individuals in jail to be replaced by people who will have the same incentive, the same structure of rewards and punishments, so that guess what? They'll end up doing the same. Let me turn now to questions that you've sent in to which I want to offer a response. A number of companies have recently been in the news in the United States, and I'm sure this is true in other countries as well, because the executives there have decided that they want employees to have more influence, more power, more say at the workplace than they normally do. A famous case is the online retailer Zappos. It believes in something called holacracy. Basically, this is a whole group of self-management schemes where you set up groups of employees who manage themselves in one way or another, rather than being supervised or controlled by a higher level of manager. Another one that got a lot of attention recently, including in the Washington Post on July 23rd, was a fellow named Dane Atkinson, who is the head of a startup with 42 workers called SumAll, based in New York. He became famous for saying that executives and managers should all be elected. And so that's what he does. He has managers be elected. Well, what do we say about this? It's nice. It's giving workers more say than they have now. I'm in favor of it. It's very nice. It doesn't change the system. Why? In order to understand that, we have to go back and make sure everybody understands how a corporation, which is how capitalist work gets done in the main, it's by corporations, large, medium, and small. How a corporation works is this way. At the very top are the people who own shares, and particularly those who own huge blocks of shares. We call them major shareholders. Once a year, they vote who's on the board of directors. That's a group of people, 15 to 20 in number. They make all the decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that production is aimed at generating. They decide all of that. The mass of workers do not participate in these decisions. If you give the mass of workers the right to elect managers, either alongside of or even instead of the directors, you still haven't dealt with the single most important question. Who are the directors and what decisions are they making? Directors decide whether we produce in the United States or in China. Directors decide whether huge amounts of the profits are given to a few people, making us have a big, wealthy class at the top, or are distributed more equally. They decide whether to use toxic mechanisms for production or to be ecologically minded. To have workers elect managers is nowhere near enough because it doesn't make the majority, workers, in a position to make the decisions that matter most. What to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. That's why for us, the name of the game is workers who direct the enterprises. Best of all, workers who own them, who therefore are in a position to elect from among themselves the workers who will be the directors, the deciders. Anything short of that does not fundamentally change capitalism. That's the crucial thing, because that's our problem. When we have a small group of people, major shareholders and the directors they elect, serving themselves by running the business of America or of any other country, they're going to do it for them at the expense of the majority. That's not democracy. That's why we're in the mess that we are in. The name of the game is to change the system. And that means, finally, putting the workers who are the majority and who depend on what is done in every enterprise in a position to make the basic decisions. Together, of course, with the communities that are affected by the decisions in enterprises. Democratic communities interacting and sharing power with democratic enterprises. That's the improvement that capitalism cannot make, has never made, and resists making with every fiber in its declining situation. We've come to the end of our first half. Please stay with me for the second half of this program. Remember our new and expanded website, democracyatwork.info. I will be back in a very short time.
Ain't shady, baby, I'm hot like the prodigal son. Pick up at the leany, meany, money, moe, and flower, you're the chosen one.
Welcome back to the second half of Economic Update for this day in August 2015. In the second half, after I make a brief announcement, we will turn to a couple of major topics. These are partly the result of my own research and partly what you have asked me to talk about. We will begin by continuing our conversation from last week about Germany and its position in the world, to finish my analysis of that that you have asked for repeatedly. But before jumping into that, let me ask you again to take a look at our new updated website, democracyatwork.info. It really is new and different. If you've been there before, you will see major changes in how it is laid out, how it works, and so on. It is, of course, as it always has been, a way for you to communicate to us, a way for you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, a way for you to see the whole range of activities we do, to pick up these programs on our archives, and a whole lot more. And as always, it is an upgraded, expanded website available to you at absolutely no charge, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year, every year. We do that in order to make a maximum of materials available to you, and we are expanding that, as you will see if you visit the website. And likewise, a reminder, the second Wednesday of every month, I give a public lecture at the historic Judson Memorial Church in Washington Square, Manhattan. If you are in New York, for example, next Wednesday, August 12th at 7:30, please come and join us. Gives me a chance to meet you, gives you a chance to meet me and to see me develop further than I can here some of the themes we try to cover on this program. 7:30, August 12th, Wednesday evening, Judson Memorial Church, historic Washington Square, New York City. Let's review where we left off last time talking about Germany. Once again, Germany is now the largest and the richest country in unified Europe. It has a leadership position as a result of this situation. Germany is the leader in Europe and is throwing its weight around, never more so than in the last 6 months since the election of the Syriza government in Greece, where Germany, with the support of most other governments in Europe, has basically imposed a crushing intensification of austerity on the Greek nation and the Greek people. I want to explain how this came about and what this tells us both about Germany and the future of a united Europe. When Germany lost the two world wars in the 20th century, it was left with staggering debts. I want to recoup that little story we told last week because it is so important and says so much in a few words. In 1953, that is 8 years after the end of World War II and the defeat of Nazi Germany in that war, the German economy was having a great deal of trouble coming back from the destruction of the war, the chaos of the Nazi regime, and the debts that it was required to pay, debts partly left over from World War I and added to by World War II, etc. Meanwhile, the West, the United States, France, and Britain above all, were engaged in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and they wanted Germany to be a strong ally since it is right up close against the Eastern European bloc dominated by the Soviet Union. The Germans saw an opportunity, wasted no time. Throughout 1953, the German representatives met with the representatives of France, Britain, and the United States in London, and the Germans demanded that their debts be relieved. Their argument was simple. We can't redevelop Germany as a strong economy unless we can use our money to rebuild our economy rather than pay debts to France, Britain, and the United States. We want debt relief. We want to not pay our debts. By the way, these were not debts entered into by politicians that were unrepresentative of their people's needs. These were debts levied on Germany because it had started World War II and had been a pariah government against which most of the rest of Europe had waged a bitter and costly war. Nobody was in a mood at the end of that war not to at least recoup some of the damage that they felt was to be blamed on Germany by making Germany have these debts to pay. But the Germans had a clever moment there. You want us to be your ally against the Soviet Union? Forgive our debts. Toward the end of 1953, the London Agreement was signed. And in that agreement, so that we're all clear what this means, half of the German debt was forgiven. It was simply erased. Half of what you owe, they owed billions and billions of dollars. Half of what you owe, you will never have to pay, end of story. But almost as good was what they did with the other half of Germany's debt. They re-stretched it so it would run over 30 years. So what it meant was half the debt is gone, and you only have to pay back the other half over a 30-year period. In effect, suddenly, starting with 1954, Germany had a trivial amount of debt repayment and could use its resources to build its economy. What Germany asked for, what Germany demanded, and what Germany got is exactly what the Syriza government demanded, asked for, and was denied by Germany above all else. Keep the story in your mind. So Germany rebuilt with the benefit of being a frontline state against the Soviet Union, the bastion of strong Cold War support. Built up with funds from outside just as much as anything the Germans themselves did. Fine, they grew, but they were still not the dominant economic power they were today. For that to happen, two things happened later, toward the end of the 20th century, that I need to go over so we all understand how and why Germany is in the position it's in now, rather than taking the self-serving stories that are coming out of certain circles at the top of the German political and economic system. Here's the first thing. Europe began a movement towards genuine unity. The Europeans were horrified by having been embroiled and destroyed in two world wars, started and chiefly fought by European countries against one another, World War I and World War II. What this did was kill millions and millions of Europeans, destroy unspeakable amounts of economic well-being, leave them with unbearable and unsustainable debts, cause hatreds, bitternesses, broken lives, injured people, ended education, the suffering unspeakable. Not only that, it meant that Europe was beginning to fall behind other powers in Europe, in Asia and in North America that they had to compete against, and they knew it. So the Europeans decided, let's try to become the United States of Europe, using as their model the United States of America. And they would move towards a common currency, which they eventually did, and move towards the elimination of borders among them. So you can drive your car from, for example, Italy into France, and there are no border guards. Nobody checks your suitcase or the trunk of your car. None of it. Goods can pass from one part of the continent to another without paying duties, rather like something that goes from Nebraska to New Jersey or vice versa. The movement towards unity was particularly good for Germany, because Germany had an industrial base. Germany had gotten lots of money from the West after getting their debts canceled. Germany was in a position to produce a lot for the rest of Europe, and now they wouldn't have to pay duty to sell goods in Spain or Italy or elsewhere. It was good for German exports, and that's what the German economy built itself on. Not only that, with European unity, Germany could do something else. In a peculiar way, its capitalists could take advantage of the success of the Socialist Party in Germany and of the trade unions. What was that success? Germany has one of the most, still does, has one of the most advanced social welfare systems in the world. People have medical care, they have good pensions, etc., etc., by and large. It's been eroded in recent years, but it's still among the best. And this created a kind of partnership between big business and labor. Big business had to pay in part for these welfare benefits. The workers even demanded seats on the board of directors of German corporations, which they got. And this kind of cozy relationship allowed the German capitalists to make a deal with the workers. If you don't demand higher wages, we won't raise prices. And we will guarantee your jobs and make unemployment small. You know how we're going to do it? Because we can control the prices of goods in this country because you agree not to push for higher wages. And the rest of Europe can't do that the way we can. And that will mean that their prices will go up, especially once there's a shared currency, whereas German prices won't go up so much. And that will mean the rest of the continent will buy more German goods, and industries in those countries will wither and die. And European Union has worked exactly that way. Germany had an ironic advantage because its workers were strong, because its workers had been able to get good benefits, and the capitalists could therefore strike a deal with them. Keep your wages from going up. We will guarantee you a good job, and the prices won't go up, so your standard of living will be good. And together, we will take advantage of the rest of Europe, which they did. The situation did not permit that sort of thing in most other European countries, particularly those in the South. But we're still not done with why Germany became so strong. The unification of Germany, 1989-1990, those years. Suddenly, the most industrially developed part of Eastern Europe, namely East Germany, the part of Germany that had been carved into a separate country at the end of World War II, East Germany was reunited with West Germany. What that gave to the capitalists in West Germany was the most disciplined, educated, skilled industrial labor force of anywhere in Eastern Europe. They suddenly came into the labor market of a unified or reunited Germany. They were used to being paid much less than their counterparts in the West, even though they were just as skilled and at least as productive. Think of any economy in the world suddenly given an infusion of highly skilled workers willing to work because they've been used to it at a considerably lower pay scale. It was a bonanza for German capitalism, the likes of which were not repeated anywhere in Europe. Yes, other parts of Europe got immigrants, but they got them from Asia or Africa, where they were poor people, probably with little or no industrial experience, with little or no education and productive skills, etc. The Germans got the dream of every capitalist: cheap, highly efficient, highly skilled workers. And they got millions of them. And they spoke the same language. And they were partly family. Unbelievable. An advantage to Germany not replicated anywhere else. Now, you might imagine, and if you did, you'd be wrong, that the German good fortune and the German experience and the success they had would allow them to be the kind of leader that could mold a unified Europe by being generous and sharing in its good fortune, rather than using European unity to basically rip off the rest of the continent, taking advantage of its special circumstances to share some of its wealth. There they didn't follow the United States example. In the United States, wealthy states subsidize cheaper ones through taxes. People in New York and California pay more, and that money finds its way to New Mexico and Mississippi, poor states. In return, Mississippi and New Mexico provide very useful things to big businesses in New York and California. Cheap labor, land, resources. But it's an attempt to weld a nation out of some sort of sharing. The Germans don't seem to get that part of it. They have made colossal enemies, not just in Greece, having savaged that country, but they have created unbelievable counteracting resistance-minded populations in Spain, Portugal, Italy, Hungary, Ireland, and the list goes on. The prospects for European unity have been set back by the extreme poverty of some parts and the extraordinary wealth of others, and the failure to understand that when capitalism works that unevenly, it creates tensions and frictions, and you better do something about it, or else you're going to have a capitalism that once again dissolves in the catastrophic wars that capitalism provoked back in the 20th century. The story of Germany is a story we will continue to monitor and follow. It is fraught with danger and problems. Last point on Germany. Part of the focus on Greece has been to distract Germans from the fact that they too suffer from austerity, that the Merkel regime has plunged many German workers into very precarious short-term jobs at very low standards of living. If she had to face the music of the anger of large sections of the German population over what their capitalists are doing to them, she'd be in a lot of more difficulty. Very convenient to tell German people the story that what is threatening them is taking care of poor folks in Greece and Spain. That way of presenting the story, in which all that Germany did to take advantage of those countries, selling them goods at prices that they were able to control, that destroyed their own industries, lending them money by giving it to their politicians under dubious circumstances, and now demanding to have the people suffer to pay it back. No. Instead, what Merkel does is present herself to the German worker as the leader who's going to not tax you for those lazy folks in other countries. Vote for me because I'm protecting you, rather than think critically about me because I am doing to you an austerity, and all I can claim is it's not as bad as the austerity I'm doing to others, which is what allows me to not do it so badly to you. It's basically a divide and conquer one part of working class in Europe and setting it against another. And that's what led to World Wars I and II, which is why I refer to the situation as dangerous. Last major topic that we'll have time for today has to do with an absurd, dysfunctional way that capitalism as a system connects economics and politics. Let me do this briefly. I've done it before, but it is something many of you write to me about. Every politician, from the president through the governors and the Congress, right down to the mayor of your town, is faced with the same political crazy situation. On the one hand, that politician has corporations and the people they make rich, corporations and the rich, who want from the government lots of services to help their businesses grow, to make their neighborhoods clean and sparkly, etc., etc., but they don't want to pay taxes. And on the other hand, they have the mass of people, the middle and lower income people, who want the government to provide them with services of all kinds, keep the streets clean, have good public schools, etc., etc., and they don't want to pay taxes because they're pressed in our economic system. So what did the politician do? He can only stay in office, he or she, if they provide the services that these two groups want, but neither of them wants to pay the taxes. If they levy taxes, people will vote against them, and the big businesses and rich won't give them the money, without which you can't be a politician. So they have to deliver the goods, and they can't tax. This is an impossible, crazy situation. But resourceful politicians have always found a way. And the major way they found is to borrow the money. If the mayor or the governor or the president borrows the money, then he or she can use the borrowed money to provide the services to business and the rich on the one hand and to the average citizen on the other without having to tax them. Of course, this is a game, because if you keep doing that, you raise the level of debt of your city, your state, or your country. And eventually, that'll have to be dealt with. But the politician knows that if I borrow successfully and give lots of services and don't tax, I'll get it voted to higher office. And so when the debts I'm accumulating come due, I won't be the politician in that place anymore. I will have been promoted to higher office. So this craziness goes on. By the way, corporations and the rich are the ones who like it the most. Because look at it from their point of view. When the mayor borrows, when the governor borrows, when the country borrows, who do you think they borrow from? From the average person, middle and lower income? Of course not. They don't have the money to lend. The bulk of the lending to the government, when they borrow in this crazy system, comes from corporations and the rich. And you can see that from their point of view, this is charming. Instead of their being taxed to enable the government to do what it needs to do for people and for them, they are instead allowed to lend the money, requiring that the government pay them that money back at a future date and pay them interest between now and that future date. No rich person and no corporation in their right mind wouldn't prefer to loan the money to the government rather than having the money be taxed by the government. It's good for them. But here comes the real kicker. When 5, 10, 15 years down the road, the debts have accumulated that this crazy system always accumulates, then the time will come when the only way to pay off those debts is to tax the people who haven't paid. And at that point, the corporations and the rich put the maximum pressure on the politicians in office then, to make the mass of people pay. And that's what austerity is. It's making the mass of people pay for the debts that were accumulated that really benefited above all corporations and the rich. Austerity is a wealth redistribution system that goes from the middle and the poor. That's why we're doing what we're doing in this country, cutting schools, cutting school teachers, cutting Social Security, cutting the maintenance of our roads. The things that the mass of people really need the most are what gets cut. The politicians dare not go after the corporations and the rich. That's why they didn't tax them in the first place. That's why they borrowed from them, so that the rich and the corporations could lend to the government rather than pay taxes. If the government had taxed corporations and the rich, it wouldn't have had to borrow anything. It would have been able to pay for the good things both communities need, but it wouldn't have had to go into debt. It chose to go into debt because that's what corporations and the rich preferred. It's not what the mass of people prefer, because when the debts finally come due, they are the ones who lose public services to raise the money to pay back corporations and the rich, who should never have been given the option of lending that money to the government in the first place. A system that works like this, that produces the savage suffering going on in Greece, the savage suffering now being imposed on Puerto Rico, the savage suffering that the city of Detroit in bankruptcy because it cannot pay the debts. This is crazy. You have provided an incentive for political leaders to find the cheapest way forward to borrow. The end result for this society is catastrophe. Capitalism is an inefficient system. We can and we should do better. When will we have the courage to see it and to face it? We've come to the end of our economic update program for this week. I want to thank you for joining me. I want to thank truthout.org, that independent source of news and analysis every single day, and I urge you to check them out. Very valuable things you will learn from them. I want to invite you, as I always do, to go to our now new and upgraded website, rdwolf.com, as we've always maintained it, but particularly the newly upgraded democracyatwork.info. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter by just clicking on the icons there. You can send us your own thoughts and questions and comments. I invite you to do that, as I invite you to join me again next week for another edition of Economic Update.
Change, change, change. Change, change, change. Change, baby. Your time now, baby. But after a while, gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.